near the end of I was at the New York Times for 34 years, and near the end of 2016, with the concussions and what we were beginning to find out about what the owners knew about concussions and how they were hiding it. You know, I was almost at the point then, I said, you know what, I'm done with this, man. You know, this is just, you know, I appreciate the fact that a lot of people are, you know, leasing their bodies and they're getting generational wealth. You know, there's an exchange. I lease the team my body, I get paid, and keep my fingers crossed that I could have a 10-year career and kind of get out of it unscathed. But, you know, it's you know, the larger question now, while we're waiting to hear what happens, you know, where does the league go from here? And I guarantee you, I would love to hear those conversations, you know, between the TV execs, the NFL people about how do we play these games? How do we keep ourselves on schedule? And I think Dante mentioned it. I think this is another conversation for another show. But to me, this is kind of also about guaranteed contracts. The NFL is the only major league whose players do not have guaranteed contracts. And NFL players, more than any other team sport, deserve guaranteed contracts. You know, you should, if you play this game, you should be taken care of. You should be, your contract should be guaranteed. And again, this really isn't the time to talk about that, but I do think that this is something really worth fighting for. The owners are saying that this is a hill they're going to die on. They're not going to do what the NBA does. They're not going to do what Major League Baseball does. But these players, if you look at what happens every single game, every single week, you know, these players need to be protected, and they need to be protected.
Interesting,
for the rest of their lives.
Bill, interesting the term you use. This is the hill they're going to die on. Well, athletes are dying. And I was wondering if Dante could respond to that. Also, looking at a piece in the Times from last year, with the addition of a 17th regular season game on top of the two extra playoff games the league added last year, the NFL negotiated substantially higher rates for its media rights. The new deals, which total more than $100 billion, nearly double the amount of the expiring contracts. What's at stake here?
Yeah, there's a lot at stake. Obviously, you know, with the NFL being a multi-billion dollar corporation, lots of money is at stake. But I do think that in this moment, with this incident being so unprecedented, I'm as skeptical as they come when it comes to multi-billion dollar corporations, no matter who they are, no matter that I'm a former player myself and still enjoy watching the game and still involved in the game by speaking with teams and things of that nature. But, you know, I do want to first, like, give the NFL some kudos. You know, that they've kind of earned the natural skepticism when anything like this of this nature happens. They've earned that over the years. But, you know, the fact that they canceled the game or they postponed the game and then said that the game wouldn't be played within the week, they're taking the steps, I think, to pretty much show that this is an unprecedented situation. And I think everything right now is fluid. But I do want to say, too, to mention kind of piggybacking, you know, about players and players' health. DeMar Hamlin was only in his second year. He is not a vested player. To be vested, you have to play, I believe it's 3 years plus three games. So essentially, you have to be in your fourth year and play three games to become vested. You have to play three games in 3 years to receive a pension. You also have to play 3 years and three games to receive the 5 years of health care that the NFL gives to players after they retired. So he has not been a vested player, so there's a lot of things that are at play here. Unfortunately for the NFL, players, that is something that can't be changed, I guess, until the new collective bargaining agreement, which they just had one last year or the year before. But those are the things that I'm concerned about.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Dante Stallworth, as well as William Roden, author of $40 Million Slaves, for joining us. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
brilliant 18th century chemist Antoine Lavoisier had decided that every substance should have a name that denotes its composition and chemical character. He's the guy who went in there and said, we've got to be more systematic about this. We've got to have names that indicate how these substances would react or behave in various circumstances. And Sachs writes about how he understood that, but he also missed the old names because they had a poetry.
Right, yeah, they do have a poetry, but there's also a mystery about them.
Yes.
All the elements ending in enium or whatever just really doesn't have a... You wouldn't put that into a rhyme, right? You wouldn't sing that as part of a song.
No, you wouldn't put it into a poem, but, I mean, it communicates a lot. It's, you know, it's doing a lot of work, the ides and the eights and the... And the different suffixes and prefixes. But I think we've lost something that we no longer talk about, jovial Bezoar.
Oh, jovial Bezoar. Bezoar being the, what's that, the something found in the stomach of goats, kind of.
Yes.
I learned that from Harry Potter, as did a lot of
people.
Oh,
really? Yeah. Oh, is it in Harry Potter?
Yeah, it's meant to cure poisons, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes. Now we've replaced jovial Bezoar with Bezoarticum joviale. I'm not even sure what that is. It's some kind of substance. But I think the jovial part has to do with Jupiter somehow. It's some alchemist term, but
so it's not even funny.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you lose something and you gain something when words change.
Well, at least you can go back to the original sources and enjoy them for what they were. And how is your turning lead into gold coming along?
Yeah, I'm still working on the lead to gold.
Okay. Let me know when you succeed. We'll retire happy. I assume that you'll share the secret with me.
Of course.
We're hoping that you, our listeners, will share your language secrets with us. So what are you thinking about? What's your question? What's your idea? 877-929-9673. Email us words@waywardradio.org or chat us up on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Nancy Nesham. I'm from Berthold, North Dakota.
Hey, Nancy.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be at your show. A few weeks ago, we were visiting our daughter in San Antonio, and I don't know what we were talking about. My husband and she and I were talking, and my husband and I said something about two bits, and she says it was something about costing, but it was something two bits, and she said, "What are you talking about?" Well, he said, "Well, two bits," and she's going, she had no idea what we were talking about. She said, my reply was, you know, two bits, four bits, six bits a dollar, all four, whatever school you were from, you stand up and holler. She'd never heard of this. And so we were trying to explain, where does two bits come from? It means 25 cents. At least that's what we understand. It's a quarter. Where did it come from?
So she'd never heard of two bits?
No, she'd never... She'll be 50 years old, for Pete's sake.
And she'd never heard of shave and haircut two bits.
No, I don't know if she has or not. I guess we never thought about throwing that one. Our older daughter knows it. I'm thinking my younger daughter probably doesn't either, but I'm going, because I'm asking people, do you know what two bits is? And the woman who works in the office here with us, she said she thought it was two nickels, because she thought that's what her father would give him, two nickels to go buy candy back in the old days. And she said, and I said, no, it's a quarter. I'm thinking, boy, I'm really old here. I think I know what two bits is.
And she got ripped off, too.
Yeah, she did. She thought it was two nickels her father was getting by really good. Where did that come from?
We are talking about a long time ago. We are talking about basically during colonial America, after the establishment of the U.S. dollar. But while there were many other currencies traveling in the world that no longer exist, including the Spanish real. And the Spanish real was this big silver coin. When you watch pirate movies and they talk about pieces of eight, this is what they're talking about. It's literally a big coin with a large number eight on it. It's a big silver coin. And if you divide that into eight pieces or eight bits, one of those pieces would be worth 12.5 cents. So since it's worth 8 reals, 1 real is worth 12.5 cents. So two of those is worth 25 cents. Therefore, two bits is worth 25 cents.
Oh my gosh.
So we learned a couple things here. We learned what a piece of eight is. We learned what two bits is. We learned about reals. So what's really interesting here, too, is eight reals being worth as much as it was way too much money. I mean, we're talking about 25 cents at the time was a lot of money. I mean, you could get a room in a boarding house and a couple of meals and maybe a little, you know, maybe your clothes washed and dried for 25 cents. We're talking about a fair amount of money. So what they would do is they would cut up these pieces of eight because they were literally made of pure silver.
Very interesting. That I learned a new thing. I just, you know, we always just, 2 bits was 25 cents.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
And that kind of stuff. Where the background comes from.
Right, shave and a haircut, right?
Shaving, you don't get that for 2 bits anymore either. So
no, you sure don't.
You gotta know somebody.
That's about it.
All right, thank you, Nancy. Take care now.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, thank you.
Bye bye.
All righty, bye bye. Call us 877-929-9673 or send your thoughts and stories about language to words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Justin Currency. I'm calling from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I'm calling because I was browsing an article on the H.J. Heinz Company's marketing slogan, 57 Varieties. And part of this was a photo of an old advertisement, and it listed several of those products, you know, familiar ones, you know, ketchup and pickles and all of that. And then one of them caught my eye. It was called Euchred Figs. So this is spelled just like the card game Euchre, and that caught my interest because I, here in Michigan, am in what's called the Euchre Belt. So that's this region where people play the card game Euchre.
And you're spelling that E-U-C-H-R-E, right? Euchre.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
And so, and that's roughly, you know, what people think of the Rust Belt. I think they're roughly similar. But that definitely extends to Western Pennsylvania and to Pittsburgh, where the Heinz Company was based. So so that got me curious. I was looking up definitions, a lot of them pertaining to the game. If you're familiar with the game, if you euchre or euke someone, it's a small upset in the game. Those obviously weren't relevant. I saw definitions from Down Under where they use euchred like knackered or tired out. Another one mentioned cheating, and I wasn't so sure about that. But the closest I got to food preparation definitions was a speculation on some old message boards. One saying it meant something akin to treated with acid, and another preserved and sweetened alcohol. So pretty much all over the map from the, you know, the food definitions there. And so I thought I would come to you. I'm slightly curious how the figs were preserved, but mostly I'm wondering how this word euchre came to be used in these two very different ways when now outside the Midwest, it's really not used at all. So I wondered if you had some insight on that.
That's so funny that you mention a euchre belt because I spent some time in Indiana and people were just looking at me like I had two heads because I didn't know what euchre was. They were just incredulous. But apparently, yes, it's very popular in that part of the country.
Let's talk about euchred figs. Like Martha said, it's E-U-C-H-R-E-D. I have an answer for you, and it comes from H.J. Heinz, the company itself. There is a document from 1910, a booklet of all their products, very nicely produced, beautiful document, and you can find it on the Internet Archive. And they define euchred figs and talk about how they're made. And they claim that euchred, and they put it in quotes, and you know that when a word is put in quotes like that, that they're calling special attention to it. They say euchred, in quotes, is Old English for preserved. And immediately we're going to stop right there and say that old is lowercase, and that's probably false. Because as far as I know, there's no earlier use of euchred used this way. I have looked in 40 dictionaries. I've looked in the deepest dictionaries that I have. I've looked in the oldest dictionaries I have. I cannot find euchred as a verb used in this way or as an adjective. So
I don't remember Beowulf eating euchred figs.
No. And now it's possible that it was spelled a different way or that I missed a trick, so to speak. But I as far as I know, this company invented this use of this word. In any case, they say it's a special kind of preserving, and it says the flat sweetness of the sugar, is modified through the tart and stimulating flavor of Heinz vinegar. So what they've done is they've mixed vinegar and sugar to preserve the figs. Says our fine old vinegar added to the sugar and choice spices, there's another thing, in preserving the liquor gives a piquant, appetizing flavor. So what we've got is vinegar, sugar, and spices to preserve the figs. And so that's what euchering a fig is.
So I'm imagining, you know, H.J. Hines and some friends sitting around a table playing euchre and not knowing what to call it and just say, oh, just say it's euchred.
Yeah, I think maybe that's true. There's always been a notion. You had mentioned that one of the verb meanings of to euchre something or someone is to cheat. But the further along is to swindle or to trick. And I think it's important that there's that notion of tricking in there. And often in card games, a trick is something that happens three times. And we've got preserving it with sugar, preserving it with vinegar, and preserving it with spices. So if you're euchering it, you're tricking it, and you're doing it with something to it three times.
Well, perfect. Well, and if you two are ever in Kalamazoo, I'll grab a fourth, and you can join us here for euchre.
Oh, you're going to have to teach me first, but I'm ready. I'm game. Thanks, Justin. Take care now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Justin.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. 877-929-9673. Here's another lovely chemical term that's been replaced, sugar of lead. Sugar of lead is now lead acetate. As I said, there's, you know, you lose something and you gain something when language changes.
Yeah, you don't want sugar of lead in your coffee. Words at waywardradio.org.
For all of our past episodes and show notes, go to waywardradio.org.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett, and we're joined by that giant among men, our quiz guy, John Chinesky.
Hey, Grant. Hi, Martha. How are you guys doing today?
All right. How about you?
Fabulous.
Just great. Just great. You know, you guys talk about a lot of things in this show, but I think it's time to talk about what we don't talk about. Now, I don't care who you are. Every family has its secrets. I mean, look at the seemingly perfect Madrigal family in Disney's movie Encanto. They sing and they dance and they laugh, but the one thing they don't talk about,
Bruno.
Bruno.
Talk about Bruno, no, no. Let's look at other family secrets and the things they don't talk about. For example, in Roman mythology, their chief god had a wife who was quite jealous of his affairs. So according to Jupiter, we don't talk about...
Juno?
Juno, no, no. Now, give me the no, no, no part.
Oh,
that's
I do?
Important.
Oh. Do I have to sing it?
Well, if you feel
you're around?
Up to it. Sure, why not? No one's watching, sure. Now, one family thought they'd make a killing in the fertilizer business, so they opened a bat farm, but they just couldn't take, you know, the smell, so they don't talk about...
Guano?
No, no, no.
Yeah, come on, really sell it for me if you would.
Guano, say, no, right. No.
Very good. Guano, no, no, no. Right. We don't talk about guano, no, no, no. All right. I had a friend in high school who was very popular and very handsome, but, you know, he gave everybody the kissing disease, so now they don't talk about...
We don't talk about mono, no, no, no.
No, no, that's right. Very good. No mono. Now, at one family reunion, everyone was enjoying the cousin's homemade wine until they find out he learned how to make it in prison. So now they don't talk about...
They don't talk about Pruno, no, no,
no. No.
I was going to say vino.
I would have taken either one of those, but
yeah,
Pruno...
Yeah, vino's good.
Yeah, Pruno is... we don't talk about Pruno. I know more than one family that are very competitive. And all it takes is one accusation of cheating during a friendly card game, and, well, now they don't talk about...
Uno, no.
Yes, we don't talk about Uno, no, no, no. And even fictional families have their secrets. The Rubbles complained about the Flintstones' noisy pet, and now they yabba-dabba don't talk about...
Dino, no, no, Dino. No, the dinosaur.
Exactly. They don't talk about Dino, no, no, no. Now, this last one is three syllables. Now, my mom's a pretty good cook, but after a thing happened involving a whole mess of Italian herbs accidentally dumped into a sauce pot, well... We don't talk about...
Oregano, no.
No, no, no. We don't talk about mom and her oregano, no, no. We do not.
Oh, well, I've just got something here. I've got a cease and desist from Lin-Manuel Miranda's people.
There we go. I was waiting on that. Well, looks like we can't talk about it anymore, so I guess it's time to end the quiz.
Thank you, John. That was, yes, 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 very fun.
Thank you.
We love playing word games, and we'd love to entertain you. Give us a call. We'll talk about language, your thoughts, your ideas, your questions, what you've been reading, 877-929-9673, words@waywardradio.org, or hit us up on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello.
Hi, who's this?
This is Marion Morrison from Powell, Wyoming.
Hello, Marion. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Marion. What's up?
Thanks. Well, I was talking with my sister about vein procedures, as in on your legs. Mm-hmm. And she had a procedure done a couple of decades ago. And I asked her why she did it, what her symptoms were. And she said, well, it was pure vanity. And in my mind, I thought, okay, she was being vain. And whenever I find words that come up organically in the same moment, it always makes me wonder if they have some kind of a common origin. So vanity coming from being vain and the veins of one's legs, I realize they're spelled slightly differently, but I wondered if they had a common root.
Actually, they're completely different words, completely different origins. They do have in common the fact that they're both really old. They've both been around for about 700 years or so. But the word vein, like a blood vessel, comes to us through Old French, and that goes back to a Latin word vena, V-E-N-A, which simply means blood vessel. And I think the much more interesting word of these two is not the vein, the noun, that's the blood vessel, but vein, the adjective, because that goes back, again, via Old French, to the Latin word vanus, V-A-N-U-S, which means empty or void. And we also get the expression in vain, you know, somebody tried in vain for something to happen. And over time, by the late 14th century, it just meant silly or foolish. And then by the late 1600s, it also came to mean conceited. So it's gone a long way from the Latin word for empty or void meaning silly or foolish. And ultimately, you know, somebody that you might kind of laugh at because they're conceited. And you mentioned vanity. And Grant and I were just having a conversation about the expression Vanity Fair.
Like the magazine or the book. Yeah. And you might never have thought about the meaning of that, but it's literally a fair, like a place of a festival for the vain, for people who are conceited. Yeah. What's the original source of that, Martha? The original...
Well, there's a reference to it in Pilgrim's Progress, or the idea of vanity, like a place called Vanity, where people were, you know, where vain people lived.
Well, I really appreciate your knowledge and research on that and for sharing it. And I really appreciate your show.
Well, we really appreciate your calling, Marion. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Grant. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You go about your day and you have these questions and you're like, oh, I got to ask Martha and Grant. And then you forget about it by the end of the day. Well, this time, don't forget. Give us a call, 877-929-9673. Write those questions down and then email us, words@waywardradio.org.
Here's a lovely passage from New York Times critic at large Wesley Morris. He was writing about crying at the movie theater and about what he called the ancient power of art to make a puddle of us. He said that seeing the movie E.T. led me into a love affair with being made to cry among strangers in the dark. I almost typed being reduced to tears, except where is the reduction? Crying for art is an honor, an exaltation, a salute. It's applause with mucus and salt. What I presume we all experienced was a willingness to give ourselves over to the ridiculous beauty of a story about feeling everything.
Oh, I love that. And you
Isn't
know
that
what?
Nice?
E.T. has a special place for me. When I showed it to my son when he was about five, and the spaceship leaves E.T. behind, my son was so distraught that he started crying, and he ran outside the house to go save E.T. because he was so upset that they left E.T. behind.
Oh, my goodness.
His little heart was broken. How could they leave him behind?
Poor guy.
Yeah, and so, yes.
Yeah, that speaks to the power.
Right, it does speak to the power.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas about language. 877-929-9673 is toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, or you can email us from anywhere in the world, words@waywardradio.org.
Hi there, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from Haddonfield, New Jersey.
Hey, Sarah, welcome.
So I wanted to talk to you about some dark or morbid or meant to be humorous sayings that my parents had. And I'm wondering whether it was because of their generation. They were both born in 1906 and lived through a lot of things. So I didn't come along till 1950. So my mother would say, you know, when you're getting ready, especially if there's a group of people and you're getting ready to leave the house or whatever, and you're saying, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? My mother would always say, I'm ready. I'm ready for Freddie. And it wasn't until I was a teenager that I asked her, well, who is Freddie? And her answer was, Freddie the Undertaker. I was I didn't know how to answer that. And here's my father didn't say things like that, but he taught me this little song that he sang all the time that's really strange. So I'm not going to sing it. But when I was little, I thought it was really funny and I wanted to learn it. So I can remember a couple of the verses. So it's called Fuzzy Wuzzy Wuzzy. Fuzzy Wuzzy Wuzzy was a wise old guy, nose like a hawk and an eagle's eye. Fooling people was his game, cause Fuzzy Wuzzy Wuzzy was the old guy's name. Now there was a little boy coming home from school, saw a silver dollar at the foot of a mule, crept up slowly, quiet as a mouse. Next day, a funeral at the little boy's house. Oh, Fuzzy Wuzzy Wuzzy was a wise old guy.
Definitely morbid.
I know. And when I was little, I thought these things were funny, but, you know, because your parents tell them like they're amusing, but...
Did you build on a cemetery?
We lived across the street from a cemetery once, but I learned these songs before we lived in that house.
I see.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, these are all good. I think phones are going to light up. The email box is going to be full because people are going to have a ton of these. I remember something about Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear. Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair, but I think that was a different one.
Right. He wasn't fuzzy, was he?
But Ready for Freddy is the one I think that's probably going to require more explanation because it's not as common as it used to be. And it's important that your mother said it was the Undertaker because that is the absolute truth. That is who Freddy is. Because we know who Freddy is, Sarah.
Okay, tell me, please.
All right, so just get this out of the way. There are a lot of incidental rhymings of Reddy and Freddy in lots of contexts for as long as Freddy's been a name and as long as Reddy's been a word. There was even a Reddy Freddy doll sold in the 1920s. But Ready for Freddy started as a catchphrase in a comic strip. The Little Abner comic strip, there's this folksy down-home strip drawn by Al Capp. Yeah, it was read by tens of millions of people. It ran in 900 newspapers from the 1930s until the 1970s. Well, Al Capp had a running gag at one point in the 1940s, and he kept teasing a line that said, "Are you ready for Freddy?" Are variations on that. And he would just keep inserting it in his strips. And he didn't explain for the longest time who Freddy was or why we needed or anybody needed to be ready. And he'd have his various characters in Dogpatch, that's the little town in the strip in Little Abner, respond to that. And so finally, after weeks of this, finally there was a payoff. Freddy shows up in the strip. And the townsfolk of Dogpatch are running around, and there he is standing in front of his shop with his name in huge letters, says Freddy's. And one of the Dogpatch locals says to him, "There they is, Freddy. Notice the eager looks in their bright little eyes. Oh, they sure is ready." And to which Fred replies, "No, they are not, son, not quite, because they are still breathing." Because Freddy, you see, was an undertaker. Freddy was the first undertaker in Dogpatch. And then he was a character.
So
yeah, Freddy was an undertaker. He was a character in the strip for long after that. So
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, my father used to read me the funny papers all the time. I can remember reading Little Abner with him, and I don't think I saw that one. At least I don't remember it anyway. But, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad that my mother.
Yeah, so that was 1947 when that happened.
Okay.
So you got an answer. How about that?
I did. I know, and I really wasn't expecting one.
Well, we hope you'll call again sometime.
Oh, I have a whole notebook of things.
Okay.
But I've been keeping
we're ready.
It's your date. Yeah, we're ready for Sarah.
Thank you so
All
much.
Take care now.
All righty.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye. Call us 877-929-9673 or send your thoughts and stories about language to words@waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hey, this is Marcus from Kingsport, Tennessee. How are you today?
Great, Marcus. Thanks for calling.
So, as kids, my sister and I, we would hear our mother make a statement, a phrase that she loved to say, usually in exasperation. But she would say, "You kids, all you ever want to do is mess and gom." Oh, that's such a strange word, gom. What, you know? But usually that was said after she had finished cleaning the kitchen and my sister and I had left snacks or crumbs or whatever. But, you know, years later, probably as a teenager and a little more brazen, I challenged her and I said, "That's not really a word. You're just making that up." And, no, this is a word. I've always heard it. I said, "Well, how do you spell it?" "Well, I don't know. Maybe G-O-M or G-O-M-B, but I don't really know." And I said, "Okay, prove it. Look it up and show it to me in a dictionary." You know, and she grabbed a Webster's or an Oxford dictionary and couldn't find it. And so I said, "See, I told you, it's not a real word." Years later, I was probably in college or maybe out of college, she had been reading a series, fictional series, and she found it was printed in one of these series books, and it was kind of set in the mid-1800s, westward expansion, pioneers, that sort of thing. And she came and she felt so vindicated. "Look, here it is. It's printed in this book." I have a suspicion that it's probably Irish or Scottish in its history, its origins, because, you know, that's where most of our ancestors came from. They immigrated from that part of the world, Ireland, Scotland, England, immigrated into the Carolinas and in Virginia, and then migrated over the mountains into eastern Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'd like to talk about.
Fantastic. Well, this certainly chimes with what we know about the word gom and the phrase messing and gomming. It sounds like you all were maybe messy little kids, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, and if you'd looked in, for example, specialty dictionaries like the Dictionary of Southern Appalachian English or the Dictionary of American Regional English, you would have found this word gom, G-A-U-M, and it's as you suggested, it's spelled a couple of different, several different ways, G-O-M, sometimes G-U-M, sometimes G-O-M-E. And since the 19th century or so, it's meant a greasy or sticky mess. It might even have to do with the grease on an axle, but we're not totally sure about that. Its origins are a little bit murky, but it might also be influenced by the word gum. But by 1859, you see citations like, "Don't let her gom herself all over with molasses," or "The baby is all gommed up with molasses." And it's sort of a word that sort of sounds like what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
In Ireland, the word gom as a verb can mean to be stupid or mope about, and as a noun, it's a foolish-looking person, so it's negative in general.
I know that my mother intended it to be negative. She was not happy when we were messing and gomming.
Messing and gomming, yeah.
Well, this is great. She'll be pleased to know that she's vindicated and that it truly is a word. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. Take care now.
Yeah, watch that messing and gone.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org.
Call a while back from Amanda in Evansville, Indiana, who was talking about the fact that their family referred to their garbage disposal as simply George. You remember that call, Grant?
Yeah, like if they had some spoiled food, they'd say, oh, just give it to George, and they'd just like, jam it down the garbage disposal.
Right. Well, we heard from Richard Martinez, who says he refers to a garbage disposal as the spoon sharpener. Makes perfect sense, sharpener. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you've ever dropped a spoon down a garbage disposal, you know what we're talking about. The spoon
Absolutely.
Sharpener.
That, you'll never forget that sound. Oh, it's like the sink is falling out. It's like it's like one of your pistons is misfiring on a transmission. It's just the worst sound.
Isn't it? It's just one of those uh-oh moments. 877-929-9673.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. We got an email from David Lauren in Chicago, who attended Catholic seminary in the 1960s. And he told us that at mealtime, they sat 16 to a table and breakfast was completely silent. As part of their discipline, nobody was allowed to speak. But you still have to ask for things to be passed to you, and so what they developed was a one-handed sign language. So if you wanted somebody to pass the milk, you extended an index finger. If you wanted the salt and pepper, you extended your first two fingers. Pass the sugar was first three fingers, and pass the cereal was just holding up your thumb. And David's email sent us down a very interesting path. Because, in fact, several religious orders take a vow of silence during mealtimes and also for many other times of the day, including what's called the Great Silence, which is 8 to 9 hours after sunset. But, of course, living in a community like that, you still need to be able to communicate about the food you're preparing or how the garden is coming along or equipment you're fixing or clothing. And for centuries, these communities developed their own highly sophisticated system of hand signals. And this was hundreds of years before the development of things like American Sign Language. And in fact, as early as the 10th century, we have records of an order of monks in France that developed a system of nearly 300 signs to use during periods of silence. And more recently, there was some fascinating work done by anthropologist Robert A. Barakat, specifically among Cistercian monks in Massachusetts in the 1970s and 80s. He compiled a comprehensive dictionary of these signs, and you can find them online. And one thing you notice right away is that many of the nouns involve combining simpler terms, like, for example, to make the sign for horse. You make the generic sign for animal, and then you pull a shock of hair just above your forehead, and you bend your head forward slightly. And then for tractor, what you do is you combine the sign for horse with the sign for the color red, which is touching your lip, the red part of your face. And so you can see sort of the etymology, I guess, of these terms. How cool is that?
I love it. Yeah. And so you can see the growth of a language that way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing, Grant, is the more that you read about all this, the more you start to understand that there's something really beautiful about being a part of a community that chooses to live in silence. And that led me to a gorgeous book called A Time to Keep Silence. It's by Patrick Lee Fermor. It was published in 2007. He writes about staying in some of the oldest monasteries in Europe, and he talks about arriving at one of them when he'd been sleepless and sluggish and depressed. But amid the enforced silence there, he finds that there were no automatic drains, such as conversation at meals, small talk, catching trains, or the 100 anxious trivialities that poison everyday life. Soon, he writes, dreamless nights came to an end with no harder shock than that of a boat's keel grounding on a lake shore.
Oh,
isn't that
perfect.
Beautiful?
Yeah, it is perfect.
We know we have plenty of listeners who have gone to silent yoga retreats, for example, or maybe you're part of a religious order and you have something to say about that. We'd love to hear about it. Our phone number is 877-929-9673, or write to us an email. That address is words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Ed from Ithaca, New York.
Hey, Ed, welcome.
What's up?
Boy, I had such a long list of things, but I think what I'll focus on is color. It kind of comes from a pet peeve of my dad's about what are the primary colors? And if I asked you, what would you say?
Red, blue, yellow?
Red, blue, yellow. Well, it actually varies. But if we're talking about light or we're talking about pigments, with light, it's actually red, blue, and green. And in pigments, it's magenta, cyan, and yellow. My dad's theory is it doesn't matter if you know it correctly or not. Even if you're teaching it, it doesn't really matter if you're teaching it correctly or not, because the only people who it matters to are, you know, artists, photographers, people in the print profession. Otherwise, it's, you know, colors are just such a random thing. I mean, different cultures have different names for different colors. Some don't even have names for things that we would consider a color. Mm-hmm. And just look at paint chips. My golly, those are just, you know, somebody makes it up.
So I want that job.
Yeah. What do you think about the fact that colors seem to be so random, and that when scientists actually agree on what they are, it doesn't matter that people don't know them, and that there is no agency, an international committee that says, okay, these are the names of colors, so we're not miscommunicating. Because we do that for so many other things. We have standards, we name things, but not colors.
That's actually right. We define colors in a scientific sense by their hertz, by the frequency of the color, the light frequency. But we don't do it by name because they are so variable, because red, in one language isn't maybe the same as red in another, and some languages might not have, for example, the color orange indicated, or a language like Russian might have two different colors two different words for blue. It's really interesting, and there's so much work has been done on this. The famous study, of course, is from the 1960s. Brent Berlin and Paul Kay did a study that found that generally, if a language had only two color terms, they were almost always black and white. And if there was one more color term, then it was going to be red. And the fourth and fifth were probably going to be green and yellow in either order. And the next was probably blue, and the next was probably brown, and so on. It's just so interesting that humans, no matter where they are, tend to create color names in approximately the same order. Another study that was done by Ted Gibson and Bevel Conway, they studied 110 languages and found that people are much better at telling other people about warm colors, that is the reds and the oranges and the yellows, than they are the cool colors like the blues and greens. Hmm. And this is because we're more attuned to the reds and oranges and yellows. So I could better convey to you, say, a magenta or a burnt sienna than I could say an ocean blue.
And colors can go with emotions too.
Yeah, that's
right. Another way of categorizing them.
And they're not the same. And then the cultural attachment of colors, like white doesn't mean the same thing in every culture. Black doesn't mean the same thing in every culture. Or purple or red. This is almost philosophical. We need a way with philosophy, because this is it's almost more than language. It's almost about the basic level of humanity, the fact that we even perceive our world through light and say, not exclusively through touch or sound or taste. This is so good. I don't have them at my fingertips right now, but there are a number of books that we've recommended over the years about colors and color names, and I think we'll attach them to the show notes for this episode just to give them another good airing, because there's so much more to this than language. There's something right at the essence of humanity, what it means to be human, to talk about color and to perceive color. and to have this really personal relationship to it. Even that very childish impulse to have a favorite color.
True. I never thought of that. But...
Ed, thank you so much for launching us off into this. I think this is a dinner conversation waiting to happen across America.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your insight, and I look forward to seeing those notes.
Bye-bye.
Great. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
And we'll take your questions at 877-929-9673 or email your thoughts and ideas to words@waywardradio.org. Hello, welcome to Away with Words.
Hi, this is Matthew from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hello, Matthew. How you doing?
I am well, thank you.
What's on your mind today, Matthew?
Well, when I was a boy, I remember my grandfather saying to me and my brothers, time to go out and get in the machine and go to the store. And I thought, machine, what does he mean? Go out and get in the machine. Sounded, I don't know, a little unnerving to me, the thought of getting in a machine. So,
like the leaf blower or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, time machine, perhaps. So, you know, we walked out the back door of his house and out to the driveway and got in the car. And... I've always wondered, why would my grandfather call his car a machine instead of calling it an automobile or just calling it a car?
When would he have been born, do you think?
My grandfather was born in 1889.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
That kind of hits the sweet spot for that, Martha, doesn't it?
It sure does. And Matthew, I'm so glad you asked about this because I have a memory of being a very small child and my dad every once in a while saying, oh, I must have left it out in the machine. And my little brother and I would just laugh and laugh because he meant the car and, you know, let's go in the machine or should we take the machine or walk? And what's really interesting about the word machine is that you might not realize how many times we've used the word machine to talk about all kinds of different things. In the 17th century, the word machine could be applied to ships and then later to horse-drawn vehicles or stagecoaches. And in the 19th century, people used the word machine sometimes to refer to bicycles and then later motorcycles. And sometimes aircraft, you know, originally when people were talking about ballooning, sometimes they would talk about flying machines. And then, of course, you have a political machine that controls a political organization. So the word machine does a whole lot of different kinds of jobs. But the one that you're talking about is really fascinating because, as Grant said, that time period really hits the sweet spot. If you look at novels from the early 20th century, say Dashiell Hammett writing in the 1920s, they mm-hmm. often use the term machine to mean automobile. You know, it was this new contrivance and a new use of the word machine.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned, you know, machine being applied to things like maybe a horse-drawn carriage, because I was thinking that, you know, perhaps my grandfather called his car a machine because, you know, when he was a young man, I would assume he mostly got around by walking or perhaps on a horse or in a horse-drawn carriage, and he would, you know, think of this newfangled mode of transportation as a machine as opposed to a horse.
Right. That would be the main machine in his life. Unless he was working, say, with sawmill machinery or something like that, he probably didn't have many other very sophisticated, high-powered equipment in his life. That makes a lot of sense. So if he was born in the 1890s?
1889.
Yeah, so he would have been... in his 20s, about the time that we first find this popping up in print in the early 1900s. Yeah, that's very
About the time the first motor cars were being, I guess, somewhat mass-produced.
Yes, exactly.
All right, well, thanks. Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For sharing that with me. And my own children, I may just say... hey, you want to go for a ride in my machine?
That's right. And they're like, where's the airplane, Dad?
All right.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew.
Bye now.
sometimes it's a memory of something your grandparents said. Sometimes it's something that your four-year-old brought home from preschool. We'd love to hear the words in your lives. 877-929-9673. Hello, welcome to Away with Words.
Hello, how are you doing? This is Eric Miles. I'm calling from New Jersey, Raleigh, New Jersey.
Welcome to the show. What's up?
So the reason I'm calling is I actually had a question instead of a, you know, the question was I was looking for a word that I'd heard a number of years back, but I've sort of since then sort of got lost. And I sort of tried to find the word again, but I haven't been able to. And the word's related to, it's basically a word that is something that's no longer needed or something that's obsolete, and but it's still simulated and used on items. And the example that I had was sort of like rivets on jeans and things like this. But, you know, I read an article a number of years about tools that were going obsolete, and there's all these tools that are no longer used. And the article just gone over, you know, a number of different tools. And eventually it moved into, the you know, rivets and things like this that are obsolete, but as an example of something that isn't used anymore either.
Yeah, you know, you were talking about the rivets on jeans. When they were introduced in the late 19th century by this Latvian immigrant, Jacob Davis, who was working with a guy named Levi Strauss, what they were doing was making these heavy-duty work clothes for miners and cowboys, and they reinforced those pants at places where they were more likely to fall apart, particularly the pockets. You know, if you're a miner working underground and you're putting things in your pockets or tools, then they might be more likely to tear there. That outdated design element that no longer serves a useful purpose, I'm hoping that the term you're looking for is skeuomorph. Does that sound familiar?
Oh my, yes, it does. Okay. That's why I couldn't remember the word, because it's a very unusual word.
I guess we should spell this word. It's S-K-E-U-O-M-O-R-P-H, skeuomorph. And another example that I like to use is the auditory skeuomorph on your phone. You know, a lot of phones, when you take a photo with the camera, it still makes that single lens reflex camera noise that is completely useless. You don't really okay. need it, right? But it still sounds like that old-fashioned camera. And there are lots of different ones like that. I'm thinking of stickies on at least on my computer. You know, I have these little post-it notes that aren't really post-it notes. They're just part of the software.
But the ones in software are a little different because those were intentional. They weren't a design change through generations of an item that merely becomes decorative. These were intentionally meant to mimic. So when we talk about copying and pasting or desktops and so forth, that was something somebody decided to do that. But
or that little floppy disk. Yeah.
Yeah. But when we talk about, for example, ceramic pots that are made to look like baskets that are woven, that's a skeuomorph.
Oh, that's okay. That is the word. And that's fascinating. So, I mean, I guess there's a host of uses now. Just for some reason, I thought it was just for physical objects. But now I realize it's actually for even the virtual world as well. So that even makes it more fascinating, more even applicable. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, our pleasure. Take care.
Okay, and have a nice day. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Sure thing. Bye. We are pretty good at coming up with the words that you once heard or once read, but now can't remember. Give us a try, 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Our team includes senior producer Stephanie Levine, engineer and editor Tim Felton, production assistant Rachel Elizabeth Weisler, and quiz guy John Chinesky.
We'd love to hear from you, no matter where you are in the world. Go to waywardradio.org/contact.
Subscribe to the podcast, hear hundreds of past episodes, and get the newsletter at waywardradio.org.
Whenever you have a language story or question, our toll-free line is open in the U.S. and Canada, 1-877-929-9673, or send your thoughts to words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
Special thanks to Michael Breslauer, Josh Eccles, Claire Grotting, Bruce Rogo, Rick Seidenworm, and Betty Willis.
Thanks for listening. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Dr. Ruth Westheimer, and if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You forgot to say who you are and with what band.
I know. Hello, this is Reza from Le Vent du Nord. You're listening to WRCP Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to the Best of Counterspin for 2022. I'm Janine Jackson. All year long, Counterspin brings you a look, as we say, behind the headlines of the mainstream news. We hope both to shine some light on aspects of news events, perspectives of those outside of power, relevant but omitted history, important things that might be pushed to the side or off the page entirely in elite media reporting. But it's also to remind us to be mindful of the practices and policies of corporate news media that just make it an unlikely arena for the inclusive, vital debate on issues that matter that we need. Counterspin is thankful to all of the activists, researchers, reporters, and advocates who appear on the show. They help us see the world more clearly as well as the role that we can play in changing it. This is just a small selection of some of them. You're listening to the Best of Counterspin for 2022, brought to you by the Media Watch Group Fair. Supply chain mayhem will likely muck up 2022. That New York Times headline got us off to a start of a year of actual hardship and a lot of obfuscation about that hardship's sources. The pandemic threw into relief many concerns that it didn't create, and it also offered an opportunity to address those concerns in a serious and not a stopgap way. Rakeen Mahboud is chief economist and managing director of policy and research at Groundwork Collaborative. We talked with her early in the year.
So we've essentially spent 50 years handing our supply chain over to mega corporations. So these companies have built a system that works for them, right? It works for padding their own profits, jacking up their profits, all spurred on by Wall Street, who really demanded short-term profit increases over all else. And so when you think about what a supply chain is for, usually most people would think, oh, it's here to deliver goods and services. Well, that's actually not what our supply chain was built to do. Our supply chain was built to really maximize what companies could get out of this and the dividends that they can pay out to shareholders. And what that means is that they've essentially built a system that has no redundancy. It has no sort of flexibility for changes in an economy such as a pandemic or even something like a climate shock, right, which we're unfortunately likely to see more of over the coming years and decades. And so there is what we call sort of a just-in-time supply system, right? This is a supply system that is expected to deliver exactly the number of goods that are needed at exactly the moment that they're needed. But with something like a pandemic, all of the predictions about what goods will be needed when go out the window, and that's when you end up with supply shortages, that's what you end up with bottlenecks. The consolidation piece of this is also really important. We have three ocean shipping alliances that carry 80% of the world's cargo. So there, if one of them goes down, that you can see how that sort of massively disrupts our global supply chain. But you can also